We're even.
Did,
is that what you're
saying? I'm actually on transportation will be made.
Don't get started yet.
President Davenport from Minnesota State University.
I've had this on the book for a long time. So.
This shouldn't take too long, but that transportation piece. That
I was supposed to be in state and local government. Good.
I wasn't sure if what you were saying is
by the time they get to state and local communities, and we're just dealing with or
right.
There's nothing really to talk about.
You built it.
The bikes are on.
I just cared. And the tape's gone because.
Good evening. This is the Committee on Health and Human Services and Housing. We're on recess. We're now back in order. We're going to begin with Senate File 2258, Senator Franzen. Welcome, Senator Franzen. Your bill is on the Adult Mental Health Case Management Services provided by a nonprofit center established to serve victims of torture, the county's share of financial responsibility requirements, eliminating those requirements.
Thank you, Madam Chair. As you mentioned, Senate File 2258 eliminates the requirement that county bears responsibility for the non-federal share of the cost for adult mental health targeted case management services provided by the Centers for Victims of Torture. The Center for Victim of Torture is the world's foremost torture survivor rehabilitation program. It was founded in 1985, and CVT has now helped more than 25,000 survivors heal from their deep wounds and reclaim their lives. This proposed change would enable torture survivors living in greater Minnesota and outlying areas of the metro area to receive the same kind of life-changing and life-saving care that torture survivors living primarily in Minneapolis and St. Paul can now receive. In 1998, the Minnesota legislature extended primary health coverage to CVT clients, first through GAMC and now with medical assistance, recognizing that an investment in their recovery represents an investment in recovering community leadership and productivity. With me, I have two testifiers, Mr. Peter Dross, Director of Policy and Development, and then Allison Beckman as well, licensed clinical social worker and clinical supervisor.
Thank you, Senator. Peter Dross, would you like to begin introducing yourself and who you represent and then begin with your testimony?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Senator Franzen, and thank you, members of the committee. My name is Peter Dross. I'm Director of Policy and Development at the Center for Victims of Torture. And as Senator Franzen said, we are the world's largest rehabilitation program for people who have survived torture. We help people who were tortured by other governments or rebel forces because of what they thought or said or did or represented. Torture leaves deep and long-lasting and often debilitating wounds. They're physical, psychological, and emotional. We help people who now live in Minnesota rebuild their lives and restore their hope. And you'll hear about a couple of those Minnesotans from my colleague, Ms. Beckman, in just a moment. At our clinic in St. Paul, we employ physicians, psychiatrists, psychologists, nurses, and social workers. We have volunteer physical therapists and massage therapists. We're in a partnership with the Health East Roselawn Clinic that is a 4-year, $3 million randomized controlled trial. We and our funding partners believe it'll document improved patient outcomes and reduced health costs when compared to the control group. We see about 300 clients annually and touch the lives of about 1,900 people each year through our work in Minnesota, including clients, family members, people we help through information and referral services, and community trainings. Since 2011 and 2012, we've provided adult mental health targeted case management services to our clients who live in Ramsey and Hennepin counties. Targeted case management is a federal program that aims to help people with serious mental health problems stay out of the hospital and function independently in the world. It's managed by states, with counties either providing those case management services themselves, their own social workers, or by contracting with third-party vendors for special and challenging populations, like torture survivors. Most of our clients live in the Twin Cities area, with the majority living in Ramsey and Hennepin counties. But Minnesota is becoming increasingly diverse, and we have growing refugee and immigrant populations in suburban areas and in communities across Minnesota. And anywhere there are refugee and immigrant populations, there will be torture survivors who could benefit from our life-changing and sometimes life-saving care. Senate File 2258 would bring this care to torture survivors who now can't get it because they live in counties other than Ramsey and Hennepin. By removing the requirement that counties pay 50% of the cost, and by relieving CVT of the need to do county-by-county contracting, we can enroll current clients who don't live in Ramsey and Hennepin counties in targeted case management. And we could begin developing partnerships like the one we have with Roselawn Clinic in greater Minnesota communities. The financial implications of the legislation are included in the handout in your packets. I'll be happy to answer any questions about our work or about the financial implications following Ms. Beckman's presentation.
Thank you. Thank you very much for your testimony. And although the committee may have some questions about the work that you do, I think the focus of the bill is on the policy change of county share. So we're particularly interested in having you help us understand why we might want to support this particular carve-out as opposed to others. Is Ms. Beckman?
Yep. Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Allison Beckman. I'm a licensed clinical social worker and targeted case management supervisor at CBT. And to orient you to our very specialized services, I'd like to tell you two extremely brief stories about clients we've helped through targeted case management and one story about somebody we could not help. The first client is named Tang. He's from Southeast Asia. He was targeted for torture because he's a Christian. He was kicked and punched until he lost consciousness, then tied to a tree on a military compound where he was left for 3 days. On the fourth day, he was moved to an indoor cell. His feet and arms were immobilized in a wooden device. He remained there in this position for 7 months. Upon his release, he fled to the United States with his wife, leaving his children with other family members. When he started at CBT, he had intense nightmares, deep depression, and difficulty concentrating. He described this feeling of becoming so immobilized and numb, he thought he was about to die. In fact, when we started to get to know him, he and his wife were actually making preparations for his funeral. He went to the ER 4 times in 5 months because of his mental health problems. He was diagnosed with panic. When Tang began at CBT, he started working with a psychiatrist, a physician, a nurse, me, a psychotherapist, and a targeted case manager. He's had no visits to the ER in the last 2 years. He is now reunited with his children, and despite our discovery that he actually had a very severe traumatic brain injury from his torture, he has made good progress at putting his life back together. The second very brief story is about Mary, who's also from Southeast Asia in her late 20s. She came to us 5 months ago with a history of multiple suicide attempts. She's married with 2 small children and was pregnant with her third at the time she became a client. A month before she began receiving services from us, she was hospitalized for depression and suicidal thoughts. While she was in the hospital, her husband had to stay home from his temporary job in order to care for their small children. When she returned home from the hospital about a week later, after being stabilized, her husband wasn't called back to his temp job. The family didn't have money to pay rent for the following month, and they were about to become homeless. Our case manager very swiftly was able to obtain an emergency grant from a local foundation to pay for 1 month. Since this time, he has found a new temporary job, and they are able to resume paying rent. So one timely action by a CBT-targeted case manager prevented a psychiatric hospitalization from causing a family to become homeless. And while she's early in her treatment with us, she has not had another psychiatric hospitalization. Her only hospitalization was to give birth to a healthy girl. The very last story I'd like to share is about a torture survivor in great need of our help, but who could not receive it because he lives too far away. James is a 56-year-old refugee and torture survivor from Iraq who has settled with his family in a small town in north-central Minnesota. He was targeted for torture by a paramilitary organization because he worked as an Arabic interpreter for American military personnel. He and his family were told they'd be killed if he continued working for the Americans. A few days later, in front of his wife and children, he was abducted from his house. He was blindfolded, stuffed in the back of a car, taken to a facility where he was brutally beaten, had his fingernails pulled out, was kept in a freezing and dark cell without food or water, and denied medical attention. After 8 days of torture, he was buried alive and left to die. He was rescued by witnesses, and his family left their country as soon as he recovered from injuries. He has since been suffering from nightmares, panic attacks, searing migraines, weight loss, and chronic pain. He relives his torture in his sleep and during daily flashbacks. He called us, asked for our help, but we couldn't help him because of travel logistics. He just wasn't able to make it down to us. Just like we do in other cases like this, we referred him to a local mental health organization in a town closer to where he and his family lived and hoped for the best. The legislation before you would help us bring our special expertise to James and others like him. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Is there anyone else who wishes to be heard on this bill? Senate File 2258. Are there any questions for Senator Franzen on this bill?
Madam Chair.
Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would like to move the bill, but I do have a question. I'm sorry, I didn't catch the testifier's name. Ms. Beckman,
yep.
Was the chair's question really answered as far as why there should be some case management?
I think the bill is really not about the work, but it's about the county share and why we should change that. I think that one of the things I heard, thank you, Senator Rosen, I was going to ask that same question too, but I think implied in what was being said is in some situations, such as the torture victims, that the burden for this is falling on the county where the center occurs, and that because they're not broad-based services, that it might be more appropriate to have a general obligation to support this rather than simply the county where the highest burden is. I heard that somewhat referred to, but I was going to ask for a further clarification because the question here is about county. The bill is about eliminating the county share. So would you like to speak to that, Mr. Dross?
Yes. Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Rosen, with torture victims residing throughout greater Minnesota, there will be communities where there are, or counties where there are relatively small numbers of them. The county-by-county contracting requirement makes it quite challenging for us to negotiate a contract with a county that has a relatively small number of beneficiaries. So, for example, it's a good investment of CVT's time to have me manage an array of relationships with county commissioners and professional staff in counties where there are large numbers. But where there are smaller numbers, it's not a good investment. Nor is it likely that those counties are going to reach out to CVT and essentially say, please, we would like to contract with you. So what this legislation would allow us to do is develop new partnerships with community-based organizations in places outside the Twin Cities area to extend those services. We wouldn't be able to develop those partnerships without relieving the counties of the 50% share and CVT of the county-by-county contracting.
Senator Hayden.
So thank you, Madam Chair, and Senator Franzen, and thank you guys for bringing the bill together. I absolutely support the work that you do and know how important it is. We did have a conversation about this bill, and my concern, and to the dismay of my county folks who are here, is Hennepin and Ramsey County kind of are paying half the cost in the way that it works. I'm just not sure how to go about figuring out how do we get these services in other counties throughout the state, but also the state then having to pick up the total cost for the bill. And right now we have a shared cost on that. And I'm a little concerned, with all due respect to the work you do, into my friends in the county that I try to support as much as possible, of alleviating them of that cost and us swallowing that in order for then us to deliver those services. I just don't, as much as I think we need to do this, I'm just not sure that this is the methodology in which we should do it, quite frankly. And I think that there's ways for us to think about how to deliver services in different parts of the state as our state grows, but not just 100% alleviate Hennepin and Ramsey County in particular of their share. And I thought if those numbers were right, it's $400,000 or $500,000 a piece or something like that. I can't remember. I'm just going off the top of my head. I'm just not sure. I mean, if it's the committee's pleasure, I just, in my mind, have not been able to kind of say that I think that that is okay in order to get what you need to have done. So I don't know if you guys want to comment, or I just am not sure where I'm at yet on if this is the right thing to do.
Madam Chair, Senator Hayden.
Senator Franson.
If you turn to one of your, you should have it in your packet, the CDT request information sheet, and in the back it has the clients we're talking about. And for 2013-2014, and I don't know if this answers your question, but just to shine light on the number of clients we're talking about, it's 145 for that year. For 2014-2015, it's 182 estimated, and then 2015-16, 195. So it's not, in the scheme of things, it sounds like a big program, but it's really probably not in the scope of a county paperwork and county scope of services. So this is trying to streamline, in my opinion, of what we're trying to accomplish is streamlining the work that CBT does to really be able to target these clients in an effective way and actually saving the state money. So that's kind of how I viewed it. And if you look at the projections, it ends up being moved over to the state, but at the same time, you're more effectively able to target those clients that need the service.
So, Madam Chair,
Senator Hayden,
Senator Franzen, maybe the best thing to do when I look at our fiscal chair here is, as we keep moving to get and these are your projections, and I think that I appreciate it. I'm not saying that, but it's to get a fiscal note on this and start to get a sense of what this would really cost and how it would work, and if our, you know, I think it's awfully hard sometimes to say what we'll save. I know I use that rationale a lot on most of the things that I do, but I think we really need to take a look at that. And then I think it sets some precedents to, you know, shifting cost. And I think we really need to talk about that. And if the greater good is to shift the cost to us so more people get served, then I'd like to just see that rationale. If not, what this looks like is Hennepin and Ramsey County are getting a break on delivering these services, and we're taking the cost. Now, I could be wrong, and I see Senator Laurie wants to get in, but that's maybe what I think we
should. Thank you, Senator Hayden. Senator Laurie.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And maybe I'll try to say the same thing in a little different way. I mean, the purpose is to expand this, you know, really quality and important care out to greater Minnesota. But step one of this plan is to take the existing, you know, structure and shift $700,000 of cost to the state before we've expanded to one additional person. It's a really, you know, coming from that perspective, the perspective of a finance chair that has to work a spreadsheet, that's a really difficult way to approach an expansion of services, is to, you know, take on $700,000 of cost for the existing population, which that doesn't really have an issue getting that access. And so, I mean, I think Senator Hayden, you know, flags a really important aspect of it. That's off the front of the sheet there. I guess the 530 a month at 182 clients, is that 530 half of the cost of the service, I'm assuming? No, that's the full
cost.
Foreign cost? Okay. So then, yeah, but anyway, $700,000 in new spending is what it says for the existing population that wouldn't have any, and then it's unclear how many we're even trying to expand to. It becomes a very expensive mechanism for the expansion.
Are there others? Senator Franz, and that's why I wanted to focus on the particulars of the bill, which is a transfer of responsibility to the state. And I'm trying to get a principle in my mind to justify that, to carve this particular group out and have it be a general fund appropriation rather than a shared cost. And I'm struggling to do that. It doesn't mean I couldn't get there at some point. But whether even if Senator Laurie could find this kind of money in his budget, which I don't think he's going to be able to find, I would still be struggling with what is the underlying principle that would help me justify this distribution at the state level without county participation and not do it for other kinds of similar kinds of situations. So,
Madam Chair,
yeah, Senator Franzen.
And the way it was explained to me, the Executive Director of Minnesota Council of Health Plans, Julie Brunner, who's on the board of CVT, explained it to me as we're probably denying some of these services to populations in greater Minnesota where this model of payment is not working for those type of clients or potential clients. So in light of making it be, you know, the same approach of payment, that doesn't discriminate against greater Minnesota clients, this seemed to be a way to, you know, sort of level the playing field is how I understood it. The share of the money, someone's going to pay for it at the end. And whether it's a county, the state, or local level, we're paying for it, whether it's in the emergency room or not. I think this is a better way to approach it and really know that we're getting to the people who need the services in a more efficient and more effective way, and probably financially. I can certainly work with fiscal, and if we need a fiscal note, but it might even be saving the state money in the long run. Those are valid questions. The way it was explained to me is that we are leaving behind certain populations and clients in greater Minnesota that are not receiving the payment because counties do not want to deal with this contracting issue that Mr. Joes had mentioned earlier.
But Senator Franzen, if there's something that we need to fix around the contracting, but if it's the counties don't want to pay their share of the costs, that's a different concept. That's a different concept. So, Senator Hayden?
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. I was just an idea, and maybe this doesn't help you, but I was intrigued by you saying Ms. Brenner was part of your board and was talking about it. Maybe this could be part of an essential benefit set that the plans be willing to pick up. And most of those clients are I imagine some of them would be PMAP participants or others. And then we can, you know, get that out there to where the need is through their health plan. Because, I mean, you're giving mental health case management and other targeted case management services. I just think that maybe that isn't an idea for this session, but I just think that there are ways. I think Senator Laurie really pointed out something, which is to really identify the needs and where they are and then start to figure out how do we pay for that as opposed to the inverse, which is to just say that the state will pick up all the cost and then we'll go out and figure out where folks are that need services. It seems to me that there's a different way that we could go about this as opposed to what we're doing today. And I do think thinking about targeted case management, I've worked on targeted case management and other mental health services and ACT teams and other things that you do. I think that there's ways that counties can continue to engage, or we start to really, create an environment where there is real parity for mental health. You know, we start to look at this thing through the lens of parity and give folks the services if they need them from organizations like yourself who do great work.
Mr. Doss.
Yes, Madam Chair, Senator Hayden and Senator Laurie, when we came up with the idea of this as a mechanism for expanding our services to communities in greater Minnesota, it wasn't an effort to first relieve counties of an obligation, Hennepin and Ramsey. It was rather the best idea that we had to have a consistent mechanism for reaching out to torture survivors, whether they lived in Ramsey and Hennepin County or whether they live in Blue Earth or Olmsted or Stearns County. So our interest is in extending these services that are life-changing and life-saving to as broad a group as possible. And so if this isn't the best financing mechanism, maybe there is another one that we could be developing. Because as I say, our interest is in helping people who can benefit from these services.
Senator Lurie.
Madam Chair, as I read this, I think that these are ineligible. These are individuals that are ineligible for medical assistance. Is it no?
Mr. Dross.
Our clients are Medicaid eligible.
They are?
Yes. It's Medicaid without federal participation.
State.
But they can't get the federal because, I mean, they're in Minnesota's Medicaid program, but without federal because they don't meet federal.
Yes, Mr. Dross.
Yes, Madam Chair, Senator Lurie. They were our clients are about one-third are refugees,
right,
and about two-thirds are asylum seekers. Asylum seekers are not eligible for federal benefits until such time as they receive their asylum. They are legal residents. So about that one-third of our clients that are refugees would be eligible for federal benefits under the Affordable Care Act and could conceivably go through the exchange. This is such a new development that we haven't we just haven't analyzed the impact on our clients in terms of co-pays and benefits. Our clients are so low income, we would have to raise additional funds to support any additional costs, and we'd be willing to do that. We just haven't had the opportunity to do that yet. Those clients who are asylum seekers, though, are only eligible under the Affordable Care Act and through the exchanges when they receive work authorization. You can't receive that work authorization for 150 days after filing for it. You have to file for your asylum within 1 year of coming into the country. So there's a period of time where our clients are not eligible for federal assistance, but only for Medicaid through Minnesota.
Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Dross, what does the $530 per month include? Is that, and how is that dollar amount? I'm just perhaps looking at the $700,000 and doing a little math here.
Yep. And you're referencing the third paragraph on the front of this page?
Yeah.
Yes, Madam Chair.
Mr. Dross.
Madam Chair, Senator Rosen, when we first negotiated a contract with Ramsey County in 2011, there was Ramsey County did a time and motion study that determined that the actual cost to CVT of providing targeted case management services is $530 per adult client per month. So that's how that rate was established.
Anyone else have any questions for the testifiers? Senator Lurie.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You know, as we work through this issue of the state-only Medicaid, I'm wondering if when you started talking about many of them are moving into a situation where they would actually be eligible for, you know, federal supports in some manner, they actually should be, my understanding is, eligible for the federal participation of the Medicaid share, too, so they wouldn't be denied that portion of the Medicaid funding once they get to a certain threshold. And I'm wondering if that's being pursued
Mr. Dross.
Actively, if there's something left on the table there.
Yes, Madam Chair, Senator Lurie. So those clients who are asylum seekers or who have received their asylum are clearly eligible.
Or medical assistance with FFP attached.
through the. I'm not the expert, but they are eligible through the Affordable Care Act to receive that coverage. So they could receive their coverage through the Minnesota Exchange. There's those two-thirds of our clients who are asylum seekers, though, do not become eligible until 180 days after they have, or until they have received their employment authorization, which is a minimum 150-day wait time. So there's at least that period of time where they are not eligible. Mm-hmm. And only would be eligible for the current Minnesota MA that they now have by virtue of the 2003 legislation.
So, Madam Chair.
Senator Lurie.
Probably the best thing to do is, I don't think anybody's going to vote against this as policy. Move it on, get a fiscal note, let the department actually price these things out and have a better conversation about the mechanism in Finance Committee.
Thank you, Senator Lurie. I if that's the wish of the committee to pass it on to Finance for further discussion, I'm just concerned that if the underlying policy question is whether or not it should be the full state's responsibility, I would not support that.
Okay.
So,
Madam Chair?
Yes, Senator Eaton.
I would like to recommend that we move it on to finance without recommendation.
There's a good suggestion. There's a very good suggestion. Would you accept that motion? Do you want to speak to that motion?
Madam Chair, just as long as you don't kill it.
It's been moved that the bill be passed to finance without recommendation. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed say nay. Passes.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members.
Okay, Senator Franzen, you are up again. 2461, home care provider licensing and compliance monitoring requirements.
Madam Chair, members, Senate file 2461, contested case timelines changes for home care providers is a agency bill. And the primary problem is that contested cases, case appeals take too long. So DHS reports on an average a contested case can take 1.5 years and can take as long as nearly 3 years. During an appeal process, a provider remains practicing because of a constitutional right for an appeal before government action. And this proposal sets a timeline where it doesn't exist right now for holding a hearing to appeal a revocation, suspension, or license renewal denial. And this proposal also shortens an existing timeline for holding hearings, reviewing a 90-day temporary suspension, and also allows for an extension of a 90-day limit of a temporary suspension if a hearing upheld the temporary suspension. And there is a concurrent revocation, a suspension, or renewal application denial pending against the provider. The last thing it does is it clarifies some changes, and I do have an author's amendment to have the bill in the shape that we want it for discussion purposes.
Do we have a copy of the amendment? Do you have a copy of the amendment? Senator Rosen offers the A1 amendment for Senate File 2461. Any discussion? Oh, Senator Rosen isn't here. I'll have to say Senator Marty offers the A1 amendment. Any discussion? All those in favor say aye. Aye. Opposed say nay. Amendment passes.
And with me, I have from the Minnesota Department of Health, Ms. Susan Winkleman, and she will go through the details of the bill and why this is needed.
Thank you. Ms. Winkleman.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Susan Winkleman. I'm the Assistant Division Director in the Division of Compliance Monitoring in the State Health Department. Among other things, we regulate and license home care providers. Senate File 2461 affects those home care providers that we license. And as Senator Franzen mentioned, This bill mostly sets timelines, shortens others, and makes some clarifying changes. The A1 amendment makes some clarifying changes, and it references the possibility of also electronically mailing or emailing a correction order to a provider. And we do, through our new changes as of 2013, request email addresses, so we would have that on file. The second change in the A1 amendment is a reflection of an agreement with the home care provider organizations. There are three of them. And we made a change on line 1.24 of the A1 amendment. We changed the word issuance and insert receipt date. And then we make a small clarifying change in 1.25 of the A1 amendment. I can go through the bill sections one by one as an overview and maybe can give you a little bit of a background very briefly.
But the emphasis on...
Brief.
Yes, on brief,
yes.
But that's not what I was going to say. With the emphasis, thank you for saying that, though. I'm glad the message is getting out. We want you to speak specifically to the issue of the bill, which is you're changing timelines in home care action in licensing actions for both permanent and temporary suspensions. So, I think what the committee needs to know, they can ask other questions if they choose to, what the reasoning is for that and why that's a good policy.
Madam Chair, members, the reasoning behind this is based on, in 2013, the legislature made an overhaul of the home care licensing process and streamlined it. It also provided a sizable appropriation increase to the department, whereby we will have tripled the number of inspectors by the time we have our full appropriation. Right now we have about 1,900 home care providers. At the beginning, or at least before the 2013 changes, we had 4 inspectors. By the time we're done, we're going to have 15. We're hoping, as always, that we do not have an increase in revocations or suspensions, but we feel that there's a reasonable possibility that we will. And this bill will help us prepare for that possibility. Right now, we do have statutory authority to take revocations, suspensions, temporary suspensions, and also deny renewals. And there is a contested case process that is in part of the requirements now. There's no timeline for holding or concluding the contested case for revocation or suspension. So, based on the fact that in our experience, because we have had so few staff, we only have 2 contested cases in the most recent history to use as examples, we went to DHS licensing and got their figures, and that's what Senator Franson was referring to before, that it, on average, a contested case takes a year and a half, and that can go up to nearly 3 years. So that's based on DHS licensing's record for the 10 most recent revocation actions that they undertook. Our experience is much less robust than DHS licensing, but we have had some experiences with contested case in this area. One of our revocations took 9 months. Apparently that's like lightning. And then we had a civil penalty that took a year and a half. So those are consistent lengths of time for the contested case process. Further, timeline change that this bill makes is in the temporary suspension. There is a requirement now in statute that the commissioner get to a contested case within 90 days. We're proposing 30 days. This is, of course, an advantage to the provider, who, when we impose a temporary suspension against them, they are they do have to stop practicing. So this would mean that we would get into a contested case review much quicker than we do now by shortening it to 30 days from 90 days. I've gotten a little bit out of order, but in the...
Senator Nelson has a question. Are you prepared for a question?
thank you very much. Before you leave Section 2, mm-hmm. I have two questions. One has to do with line 2.29. You're striking the words when there could be a suspension. For the safety or health of a consumer is in imminent danger, and you're replacing that with there are level 3 or 4 violations as defined. Can you, I suppose I could look it up, but maybe you can tell me. I don't know what level 3 and 4 violations are, and how are they different from the health or safety of a consumer being in imminent danger?
Ms. Winkleman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Nelson, be happy to. The level 3 and 4 distinction or clarification was a request of the providers. We've had several discussions with them about these provisions. And imminent danger, while it is the existing phraseology within our laws, they wanted a little bit more clarification. Levels 3 and 4 come from our 2013 changes. Level 3 violation is that which has harmed a client's health or safety, not including serious injury, impairment, or death, or a violation that has the potential to lead to serious injury, impairment, or death. And then level 4 is that which results in serious injury, impairment, or death. And so those are the two examples of when we would be imposing a temporary suspension.
Thank you. And, Madam Chair, my second question.
Senator Nelson.
When you said that a provider would need to stop practicing, which I understand would be in case of these serious infractions, but my question is, is there more than one client there? And what happens to the clients when suddenly the place where they're living is now closed for 30 days?
Ms. Winkleman.
Madam Chair, Senator Nelson, there are provisions within the rest of the home care chapter that address when the commissioner takes some sort of serious action, and there is a transfer mechanism for the provider to make sure that the clients are well aware of it. In home care, it is true that it can be a wide variety of services, from activities of daily living where it's a couple of hours a day all the way to 24/7 care. When the commissioner is considering very serious action, we are very much in contact with the counties. We don't make a move before we know that we know who the clients are, what their care level is, and how we can best address their home care needs.
Thank you. Please continue.
So Section 1 is the more of a clarifying change, and this is an agreement with the providers, and it just makes it sets a requirement of 15 calendar days for a provider to request an internal reconsideration of a correction order. That was something that was omitted in the 2013 session. Section 2 is what Senator Nelson was referring to, which is clarifying the meaning of imminent danger for the reasons why we can take a temporary suspension. And then secondly, the second part of Section 2 shortens the timeline that we are required to get into a contested case for a temporary suspension, 230 days from 90. Section 3 addresses the problem about the contested cases taking too long and sets a timeline where none exists right now. And that is requiring us to request a hearing within 90 days. It allows the administrative law judge to extend it for up to a second 90 days for good cause. That's certainly within the administrative law judge's purview and right. And it also reiterates the commissioner's existing authority to take or impose a temporary suspension if we detect new serious violations during the pendency of that action. Section 4 is very procedural and laden with all sorts of timelines for how we must request an ALJ assignment for a temporary suspension. We have to request it within 5 days. The hearing has to be within 30 days. The scope of the hearing, of course, is limited to the temporary suspension justification, which it would be anyway. The ALJ has to issue his or her findings within 10 days and so on. It also states that if there is a final order that upholds the temporary suspension, and that would be done under these provisions within 30 days, And there is also a concurrent revocation action pending, an appeal pending, and then that would have the 90-day requirement. Then the temporary suspension period would last until the secondary revocation action is concluded. And as an example of how that might happen, in some cases, and in fact one of the two contested case proceedings that we discussed today, we did concurrently apply a temporary suspension along with a revocation action onto the provider in question. And that meant that they were to cease practicing immediately. But then as it happened, the temporary suspension ran out. They returned to practice, and a revocation action continued beyond that. And so that is what this last part of Section 4 would address.
Thank you. Are there any questions from the committee members? Are there any further questions? All right, then we need a motion. Is there anyone else wishing to testify? So, Senator Nelson, would you like to move Senate File 2461, Senator Franzen's Home Care Provider Licensing Bill?
So moved.
As amended. And it would be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Very good. Any further discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed say nay. Passes. Thank you very much, Senator. Senator Sharon.
Thank you very much. I'm here to present Senate File 2660. It's the non-emergency medical transportation services legislation. In your materials, you should have a brief summary of the findings of the medical non-emergency transportation review by the Office of the Legislative Auditor. And also a letter, it looks like, from the Chamber and a letter from the Minnesota Hospital Association. I would especially want to draw your attention to the summary from the Office of the Legislative Auditor, simply to give background and context to the long history of discussion and struggle about how to improve services to persons who have eligibility for this medical transportation to get to their medical appointments, the struggles to determine how to best organize that and provide that so that the geographic differences in the state in terms of access to various modes of transportation are different. It's been difficult for us to get all the players together to figure out how to put together a package of policy statements that will guide how we manage our non-emergency medical transportation. After the auditor's report, it was recommended that a task force be formed. It was formed to work on making recommendations to the overall non-emergency medical transportation process. Up until that time, we had sort of been piecemeal initiating legislation, changing the rate structure, introducing RUCA into the rate structure, eliminating the use of the automatic use of a broker by the state, at least for reviewing special transportation levels of care, just a variety of piecemeal changes that seem to create more confusion and difficulty for the various providers throughout the state, as well as for confusion for those who need this service. So this task force has been working now for about 2 years, right? Is that correct, Ms. Abderholden? And it's been a very, very dedicated group of people that have represented the Department of Human Services, the Department of Transportation, the counties, both rural and urban counties, representatives of the persons who of the disability community that need this service, and members of the legislature. I hope I didn't leave anybody out, but if I did, please kill me later. So we have just recently been able to put together the final touches on this bill, so I'm really excited to be able to present it to you tonight. And there may be just a little more tweaking that we need to do in order to resolve some issues with that we can take care of in transportation, which is the next place where this will go in terms of responsibilities for the Department of Transportation and the Department of Human Services. So with that, I just would really want to also thank not only the members of this committee that have worked hard, many of whom are here. Dan Pappin is here, I see. And, I mean, just so many who've worked so hard, but especially Sue Abderholen, who is sitting right next to me here. She chaired this committee, and believe me, that was a major, major contribution to the state of Minnesota, and we really should be grateful. Because she chaired it, she gets the honor of being able to describe the essential elements of what is that is in front of you tonight.
Senator Sharon, would you like to move the author's amendment, the A1 amendment, before
appreciate
we do that?
That. Or do you Thank you very much. I would like to offer the A1 amendment.
Senator Sharon offers the A1 amendment. Is there any discussion? All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? Motion passes. Please proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Sue Abderholen, Executive Director of NAMI Minnesota and the co-chair of the NEMT Advisory Committee. And truthfully, what you have before you is nothing short of a miracle. I have worked on a lot of contentious, difficult issues over the past 30 years, but I have to say this was one of the most difficult tasks ever put before me. You have a group of stakeholders who have very, very different perspectives, and I want you to be sure that you know this so that you understand that the bill reflects a fragile and carefully worded compromise, and I want to urge you to resist any temptation to change it. We have people in this room who have become to, you know, almost be friends with, that we've, you know, really gotten to know each other and work hard on these issues. I do want to say that the concerns that were laid out in the 2011 OLA report, we really have addressed many of them. The OLA recommended that a single administrative structure be established and that DHS, you know, bring a recommendation back. They also recommended addressing a number of other issues, including the length of time people are eligible for special transportation, the frequency of assessments, clarifying eligibility policies when special transportation is not available, and collecting key performance data. While we didn't meet the deadline of last year, we are here today. And again, a great deal of work has been completed. We've been meeting twice a month, sometimes more, and despite the difficulties, I'm really proud of our committee's work. We do now have a policy manual that addresses many of the issues from the OLA report. The bill before you does contain our committee's recommendations. The single administrative structure for fee-for-service will be housed within the counties who currently administer what we call ATS. However, in order to make this work for the providers, we need to have technology available statewide to have a web-based system to facilitate the enrollment process, eligibility determination, assigning the mode, and reconciling trip information with claiming. There are systems out there, they just aren't statewide yet. And so we're providing a 2-year delay of the single administrative structure until this can be built. All providers of NEMT except public transportation and the volunteer drivers will have to meet NEMT vehicle and driver requirements. This will provide some assurances that some of our most vulnerable children and adults are being transported in safe vehicles with good drivers. A fee would cover the cost of inspecting these new vehicles. A new rule, of course, would also have to be developed, which will provide clear NEMT-specific guidelines and include training in mental health where appropriate. And we know we're still working with DOT on just one other amendment. The agencies of this single administrative structure will need to use the policy manual, where we actually have a flow chart for call intake. This includes asking if a one-time trip upgrade is needed, for instance, for the weather. It also creates a level of service assessment application that can be filled out by a medical or a mental health professional. And you might remember the OLA report actually said that sometimes the assessments of people with a mental illness were not accurate, so this will help that. We will be able to examine data regarding complaints and appeals. There will be no wrong door for the recipient in filing a complaint, and we'll be able to monitor and assess them. The bill outlines the new modes of transportation, so we don't have to think about curb-to-curb, door-to-door, door-through-door, any of those kinds of confusing terms. So we'll have the client reimbursement, the volunteer transport, unassisted transport, assisted transport, lift-equipped transport, protected transport, and stretcher transport. I do want to point out that protected, which is the one thing I got out of this bill, is a really important aspect for the mental health community. By having protected transport, it bases it on the Transporting with Dignity report that came out a couple of years ago. We won't have to use, people won't have to be handcuffed and put in the back of a sheriff's car, or they won't have to be tied down in an ambulance. This is a much cheaper way to go, and we've put together some kind of requirements to make sure people have the training in mental health and de-escalation and things like that. But I think that will be an exciting new change. During this interim period, the counties will continue to administer the client, volunteer, and unassisted, with the state doing the remaining ones. We're trying to figure out what to do with the assisted category, since counties and the states did do both, but we're close, I think, to getting an agreement, which will be ready by the time it gets to finance. We want to make sure that it's really client-centered, and so for the client, that they don't enter the wrong door. So kind of whatever door they enter, they're going to be able to get that help. You will note that the payment is by mode, not the type of vehicle used, and we do provide an increase in the mileage rate for clients and volunteers in order to encourage these most inexpensive modes. Volunteer rates would be up to 200%, and I want to mention that it's up to because, one, we wanted to try to address those no-load miles, but on the other hand, some volunteers might not want to accept that increased rate because for volunteers, any amount over the IRS rate is counted as income, and so some people might not want to do that. We did put in a way to adjust the rates when the gas prices go up. That would be helpful. And then the rates for providers would go up by eliminating the previous 4.5% reduction. The advisory committee would continue to meet so that we can add to the policy manual and address any issues that arise. We would meet at least quarterly in the beginning as we really kind of roll out this new process. The membership has changed slightly so that we have almost an equal number of providers, counties, and advocates. While I've joked that, this has kind of been a really difficult committee to chair, I will also say that it probably has the most passionate people that I've met. Who knew that discussions surrounding transportation could evoke such passionate arguments? Through very, very hard work, we really have a compromise before you. It's not a perfect solution. Not everyone is thrilled, but it's workable, it's good for the clients, and it addresses many of the concerns that have been raised by the OLA report, and most importantly, it moves us forward. And I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Are there any questions for this testifier? Senator Hoffman.
Thank you. Ms. Abbott-Holden, thank you for your comments. A couple of questions. How are we, as we're looking at changing how we provide cost savings and cost assurances to different organizations, using taxi cabs, and I'm going to go back to, I'm going to have a question with a comment. How are you organizing with the home and community-based services providers, because it looks like the pay rate's different there than it is with what you're suggesting. And I can give an anecdotal of a taxi cab use just today. An individual charged back to an HCBS provider $55 for transporting using taxi cabs. And so as I see you inserting taxi cabs, tell me how we're going to get some cost savings and assurances, and that's the first question, and how are we aligning ourselves with the HCBS providers, because I noted on page 5 that there are some differentiations in the cost structure. So just help me understand that, please.
Ms. Abdur-Holden?
Madam Chair, Senator Hoffman, first of all, we already use cabs. They're already part, they're kind of the old ATS, so we've been using them. The difference here is that they would have to meet the same standards as all the other NEMT providers in terms of the vehicle inspection and the driver standards. I have no idea how this works with the home and community-based services because we're really just focusing on non-emergency medical transportation, which is available for any Medicaid recipient. So I'm going to, unless my, you know, everyone is looking at me, I'm not sure how they connect, to be honest.
Yes, and I just would reiterate what Ms. Abdur-Holden said earlier, that these, in the old system, it was the ATS and STS. We've now shifted to something called modes, and the modes give a clear description so that when an initial assessment is done to determine what the needs of the client are, it is a descriptor of these various modes, and then that is the selected mode of transportation most of the time, unless there's weather problems or there may be an occasion where a certain type of transportation is not available, so there has to be an intermediary solution. And the payment rate then is established based on that mode. That's for this particular benefit that people have under this program.
Senator Hoffman?
Thank you, Madam Chair and Senator Sharon. You know, as we look at CMS has been, you know, hitting the Department of Human Services in our state to change how we do business. And it just is dawning on me that we have all these different fragmented ways that we provide services and supports to people. And this just kind of came up to me as a aha. And as I look at that, I'm wondering just what we're doing to create some kind of consistency and structure within how we provide the services. So I guess this is going to go to another committee, and I'll have some more questions, which I do have, and I think I'll just, you know, save those for the Department of Human Services and to the Medicare providers that or Medicaid providers that provide these types of services. So thank you for all your work that you've done on this. It still leaves a lot of questions to be answered, but great work on doing this.
Any other questions, committee members? There was another testifier listed, Laura Rhodes. Is she here? And please, welcome, and please introduce yourself.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Laura Rhodes, staff attorney in MnDOT's Office of Freight and Commercial Vehicle Operations. Among other things, our office regulates limousines, motor carriers of passengers, and special transportation service vehicles. I have had the chance to attend the NEMT Advisory Committee meeting since August, and have seen all of the hard work, or in those months have seen the hard work that and efforts that has gone into the advisory committee, so I'm not unaware of that. The STS program has been in place since the late 70s and early 80s. Prior to the STS rules being written, there were a lot of complaints about bad driver behavior. Rules were written with a very specific population in mind, which is the elderly and disabled. Since the initial adoption of the rules and an update to the rules in 2004, MnDOT has worked very hard to get the STS program where it is today. We currently have 205 STS providers and 2,378 vehicles. I've spoken with someone in our finance office at MnDOT, and they are working on a fiscal note with an estimated completion date of late this week or early next week. Based on those numbers that I just gave you, the 205 providers and the 2,378 vehicles, that averages out to about 11 vehicles per provider. This isn't necessarily how it works in practice. We have there are plenty of single vehicle providers and also providers who have a fleet of vehicles. Currently, we have one supervisor that supervises seven full-time employees. These employees spend approximately 50% of their time on STS-related tasks. Based on those numbers, we have come up with a formula that it would take approximately 3.5 full-time employees per 200 providers. And so we are not here today in necessarily opposition nor support, but Senate File 2660 would potentially affect MnDOT's STS program. The work in this area of MnDOT is specialized enough that the classification of employee sought for this work is a Transportation Program Specialist, or TPS 3. The salary range for a TPS 3 without benefits or fringes is $43,911, and the other end is $64,457. In addition to the salary, there is a cost of approximately $5,000 per employee for miscellaneous work items, such as uniform, cell phone, computer, printer, training, outstate travel, etc. Each employee would need a MnDOT vehicle, which costs approximately $31,000. We estimate that it would take about 6 months to hire and train new employees. Currently, those seven full-time employees we have are spread out throughout the state, not perfectly, but we have employees working out of Golden Valley, Glencoe, Baxter, St. Cloud, Rochester, Mankato, and Hastings. So what some of our concerns are with this bill is that it, in let's see here, on page 2, lines 2.9 to 2.12, all non-emergency medical transportation providers must comply with the operating standards for special transportation service as defined in sections 174.29 to 174.30 and all applicable Minnesota rules and in consultation with the Minnesota Department of Transportation. And so what we're hoping for is just that, is to be part of this effort, to be in consultation so that we can work to create a program that can eventually be as successful as our STS program. And so my purpose in sharing some of those numbers that will go into the fiscal note is just to give you an idea of what goes into our program and the work that is involved. And currently I don't believe we have an idea of how many vehicles or providers will be new to the NEMT program, and so that is part of our concern, is how would we work to regulate those new vehicles. Additionally, the policy manual sets out that MnDOT would be required to create rules for the NEMT program, and we're concerned that there isn't specific rulemaking authority set out in the bill. In section, in Minnesota Statute 174.30, that sets out our rulemaking authority for the STS program, and so we would hope that in moving forward there would be some specific direction from DHS to help MnDOT understand what types of rules would be necessary to regulate the NEMT vehicles and providers. We are also concerned with the effective date, and that's something that Sue and I talked about previously or prior to this hearing. But because of the nature of the STS program, Any STS provider must have their vehicle inspected prior to providing STS services. And so that would be something where we would need to make sure that there was a phase-in date or something to allow for all of those inspections to take place prior to an effective date starting. We wouldn't want some sort of, you know, backlog of vehicles that need to be inspected before they can go into service and provide the NEMT services. I think our last concern is the fee language, and that is on
page 10.
That is 10.31 through 10.33. We are concerned that the language that's currently in the bill is vague in terms of what the actual dollar amount of the cost would be. Currently, there is no cost for STS providers, and so to have a cost and not necessarily any direction of what would be used or how what information we would have to I guess decide that cost or determine that cost is something that we are concerned about. The potential implications of this bill are to the commercial vehicle section in MnDOT are complex, and we would prefer not to make a quick fix that may have unintended consequences or may cause confusion. We are optimistic about continuing to work with the author on changes to the bill and find language to make the regulation of NEMT successful and efficient.
Thank you. Thank you, Ms. Rhodes. Are there any questions for Ms. Rhodes?
We'd like to...
Yes, next I was going to ask.
We're going to respond because this is what I was referring to earlier, that there are issues that we're going to continue to work on. We'll be hearing this bill on transportation, and I'll have Ms. Afterholden speak more, but, you know, it's hard to put down a specific dollar amount until we get a fiscal note, but the intention of the providers is they've agreed to pay the inspection fee in order to cover the costs of having all of these vehicles be inspected. We understand the concern about maybe an incremental phasing in of those vehicles that have not been inspected in the past, but the committee is quite insistent that if you have vehicles wanting to serve this particular special population, that we ought to be absolutely certain that the vehicles that are transporting them are safe, clean, and meet the same standards as any vehicle transporting the disabled, the elderly, or others who are really vulnerable. And rulemaking, we understand the concern about rulemaking. We're beginning to work on that language to make certain that they have the authority to do what we're asking them to do in this bill.
Ms. Abderholland?
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. So the idea that we have is that NEMT providers would seek a waiver from the Department of Human Services for those vehicles that would now have to meet these standards. That will give us the number of cabs or whatever that would actually need to be certified in the future. And we would have perhaps a year kind of phase in so that, you know, that would give the Department of Transportation time to kind of ramp up and know how many vehicles they would actually have to certify. And that will actually also in turn help figure out what that dollar cost would be. Because they would have a waiver request that would go to the department. The Department of Human Services would then transmit that information to DOT. And we'd have a very good idea, because they would have to get the waiver in order to get Medicaid funding, we'd have a very good idea of how many vehicles we're talking about. Because right now, to be honest, none of us know. And this would give us really good, hard data.
Are there any questions? Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My question revolves around language on 3.5 through 3.7. And I think it's clear here, but I just need some additional clarification. The requirement is that there's trip logs that include a timestamp signed by a medical provider, I'm on 3.6, or client attesting mileage to
obtain. Senator Nelson, would you refer to, make sure that you're referring to the A1 amendment.
Oh.
We did make some language change there. You may
check
still
that.
Have questions.
My concern was about medical providers and asking medical providers to attest to this. And also, it just said who it would be determined by whichever is deemed most appropriate. And my question was, who does the deeming about what's appropriate? So has my question been answered in the A1?
Madam Chair, Only half of that has been answered. The other thing is that right now, often if someone needs what we call door-through-door, and my providers will tell me if I'm wrong, if it's door-through-door, they actually, like the receptionist at the doctor's office, just signs it. It's not actually the physician. Is that right? Okay. And then if you don't have any assistance, then you have to have the client sign it because they're not, you know, the driver is not going into the doctor's office with the person. So you want some verification, the client, if that's appropriate, because you're not helping them. And if you're actually bringing them all the way in, you can have the receptionist sign off.
So, Senator Nelson?
Thank you, Madam Chair. So it was, the amendment is around this language, but it didn't exactly remove the, that it needs to be signed by the medical provider. And I know what you're telling me, I understand, but the language says that it's either that medical provider or the client, but whichever is deemed most appropriate. Who does the deeming? Who makes that decision about which is most appropriate?
Ms. Abderholden?
Madam Chair, Senator Nelson, it really goes back to if you're helping that person or not. It's the mode of transportation. So if someone is on, you know, they're just getting dropped off at the curb, well, you're not, it would not be appropriate then for the driver to follow the person inside. But if the person is, the driver is actually helping the person into the building and, you know, up to the receptionist desk, then it's very easy for them to do that. Everyone seemed to think that this was a pretty easy thing to do. And it's really based on the mode of travel. So if you have assisted transport, you have someone who's actually helping the person, and they can get that easily enough.
Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, there are cases of assisted transport where the driver does not leave the vehicle. Someone from the institution meets at the curb and takes the client in. So I just need to tell you I'm a little uncomfortable with this language. Thinking how I can see how it could play. I wish there were more clarification regarding this piece. The last thing we want is for medical providers to be running down and signing forms on the curb, because there are times when where actually the medical institution meets the assisted client. Many times I see it routinely. Meets the assisted client at the curb and takes them into the medical provider. And so I want to make sure that we're not throwing this into that arena.
Madam Chair, Senator
Ms.
Nelson, I'll go back to the committee and see if there's a way to close.
Thank you very much.
Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And as long as we're looking at some getting deeper in the weeds, I spent a number of my years working in juvenile detention facilities. I was not a member of one, but I actually was a supervisor. And we spent a lot of time looking at prone positions. And you have some language in here that causes me to have some anxiety feelings. When you talk about prone positions, it's people that are in a body position that lies flat. And so I'm wondering if there's any clarification around. And I don't want to have a MeToo incident that occurred in this great state of ours again, but when you start to use prone position without any clarification of what do you mean in prone position, are you talking about a 5-point restraint? Are you saying to somebody, it causes some concern on my part, both as an advocate for disability and as a professional, that language is ambiguous and without clarification of what you mean by prone position. So please, Ms. Abderholden, explain this prone position.
Yes, Madam Ms. Abderholden. Chair, Senator Hoffman. So this prone has nothing to do with seclusion and restraints at all. When someone gets a level of service need assessed, there are some people who cannot sit upright. And so it really is talking about how they travel in their wheelchair, you know, whatever it is in terms of how they travel. This is not a restrictive procedure at all. This is language that has been used for many, many years, and we have not had any complaints or problems with that, because this is just transporting someone from one medical facility to the next, from their home to a medical facility, from the nursing home to the medical facility. This is this is not and has not been used that way in all the time that I've been around.
Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Then I would like some kind of language that clearly identifies that this is not what you say it is, because without clarification, I've seen in my professional history, and I can sure be more than happy to sit down and share with you many, many times of deprivation and aversion practices that have occurred out of the right to do what is right. And so I would like to see some kind of clarification about when you say prone, you're saying non-aversion and deprivation. And I haven't seen it in here yet, but maybe it is. Maybe it's assumed, but I'd like to see some clarification.
Senator Hoffman, do you have a specific page?
Yeah, Madam Chair, thank you. Page 4, you start looking at 4.14. It talks about protected transport provider. But then it uses the when you start to see prone or supine positions, then without any clarification about where we're going, I'm thinking it leaves too much for interpretation of some ambiguity, which creates lawsuits in this state.
Ms. Abderholden?
Madam Chair, Senator Hoffman, I think the thing to remember is that everyone goes through a level of needs assessment about what type of mode of transportation that they need. So you would have a doctor, you know, most likely in this kind of situation, saying this person needs stretcher because they can't sit up. So it is the medical professional that's saying how this person is transported. I mean, as someone who helped pass the very first Rule 40 in the 1980s, trust me, this is an issue that I've cared about for a very long time, schools, everywhere else. But it has never, honestly, that issue has never entered into non-emergency medical transportation. I mean, in the many years that I've been around, it really is those are procedures that are used in, you know, as you know, sometimes in group homes, in the institutions, in MEDO, you know, sometimes in our schools, but it is just because it's not the transporter who's deciding how someone gets transported. It is the professionals who are assessing that person in terms of what they need, whether it's the, you know, because of their vulnerabilities, they need to have someone with them, whatever it might be, but it's never been interpreted that way, truly.
Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate your advocacy, and I've known you for many years on this. I want to support this, and I do want to see this happen, but when I see the ambiguity of prone positions, I just, you know, I get a little etchy when it comes to public policy side. So if you could perhaps clarify for me, maybe if, you know, this is the next stop, and maybe it's in rulemaking or it's in some clarification form, but anytime we leave some ambiguity on that, it causes me to get a little on edge, anxiety. So I know where you're coming from, Ms. Abderholden, and I really do. I mean, you're a big advocate for this stuff, and let's not leave the interpretation to ambiguity. Let's make it very clear. So that's just a comment, I guess, Madam Chair.
Senator Nelson.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. And I don't want to belabor this. I know the day's been long for all of us, but I neglected to thank you and Senator Sharon for working so hard on this. I know it's been a contentious issue well before I got to the Senate, and I know there was some real need for reform. And I particularly like what I saw about the modes of transportation. That sounds like a really thoughtful way to look at reimbursement. I have one brief question, and I hope it's not too lengthy, but I'm reminded of an issue in my district. Can you briefly explain to me the difference between a single administrative structure, like kind of describe what that is, and then describe to me what the broker model is?
If you look at the
Senator Sharon,
if you look at the legislative auditor's report, it describes that there does not exist a single administrative structure, that there is the STS and the ATS system.
Yes.
ATS is the alternative transportation system, and STS is the special transportation system. That has been now changed into modes. so that the person moves through various modes of transportation rather than two separate systems.
I understand that part. Maybe these two issues are not – it's the single administrative structure. Are we talking – let me just tell you about the issue in my district, and you'll tell me if this addresses it. There was a point where – I don't know, there was going to be a single statewide third-party broker or something for non-emergency medical services out of Missouri, I think it was. And there were all kinds of issues regarding that, the way that company from Missouri was going to administer all of these rides. And I think it eventually was pulled back. But is that what we're talking about here, or is this totally something different?
Senator Sharon.
Let's see. This policy here relates to the fee-for-service portion of our program. The situation you're describing was a change in procedure by Blue Cross Blue Shield for public programs that they were managing, which are not impacted by this piece of legislation. But they had made a decision to move to hiring a broker to administrate their book of business. That's where you saw a lot of people become very anxious and agitated and ask for that decision to be reversed so there could be more time and conversation to engage in trying to understand what the problems were that that Blue Cross Blue Shield was having with their public program transportation management.
Thank you.
But the broker is the same regardless. The broker is an organization that you contract with to carry out certain administrative functions in the same way that you'd contract with an HMO maybe to carry out certain functions for a book of business.
So, Madam Chair, just one follow-up question. Thank you for that clarification. And then, so is there anything in this single administrative structure, and I see that's one of the OLA recommendations, that would at all prohibit or infringe upon the many different commercial services that provide non-emergency medical transport? Is there anything in this that would in any way lessen the amount of providers who might be providing this type of transport?
Senator Sharon.
The county still can use a broker to organize and manage their system if they choose to. And depending on how they establish a contract with a broker, in the same way that we establish a contract with an HMO, the HMO may restrict the persons who can provide services within a certain concept. So it depends on how the county establishes the contract and what the limitations and restrictions that those counties would identify in the contract with a broker.
And so, Madam Chair.
Senator Nelson.
So there's nothing, though, in this particular language that changes that at all. And what I'm reading about a single administrative structure is not that mechanism that would change that.
No.
Thank you. I just need a clarification.
And there's nothing in this bill that stops a county from using a broker should they choose to do that to manage administrative. I mean, if they're contracting out a responsibility that they have to an organization to manage for them, that's allowed in this
system. Thank you. Thank you very much. That answered my questions.
Any additional questions? Senator Marty?
Just, Madam Chair, just one comment, and that is having watched the wars on this in the last several years, I'm glad you were finally able to, I'll use the word broker, a piece here.
Any other questions? Senator Lurie?
Mine was a similar, is this going to be the last we have to hear of this?
Absolutely.
That is my intent.
You're going to see me at this table.
If we vote yes, this is okay. Just so everybody understands that.
Another important for those of you that weren't here, this has gone through lots of conflicts, and I would say that there were representatives of the contract broker that we have utilized in the state at the table as well. And so all their interests, their particular difficulties and problems of trying to provide services using a broker system were there too. So, you know, it was, you know, a real struggle to try to get to this place. So we really do appreciate your understanding that that it is fragile, it's delicate, and the agreement is based on what's written here. And if you can find comfort, enough comfort with what is here without asking us to change things in a substantive way, we would very much appreciate that.
Madam
Senator Lori.
And I that last comment was somewhat facetious, but honestly, I know, Senator Sharon, you have been dedicating a significant amount of your time since you and I got elected together a long time ago, and I really do thank you for all of your work and think that this is a pretty decent direction. And
well, thank you, Senator Lori, but I got to tell you that the people that are sitting yes. behind us here are really the ones that have just absolutely stayed at it and stayed engaged in the conversation even when they were ready to kill each other. So I'm really very appreciative of that.
any other questions or discussion? Senator Sharon, do you want to move your bill?
Senate File 2660 be passed and referred to the Committee on Transportation.
As amended?
As amended.
All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
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 Any opposed?
Thank you very much. We can adjourn the meeting.
The meeting is adjourned.